Why am I not hearing anything?
Live from Lane County, Oregon, it's the Bo's Nose Show with your host, West Lane County Commissioner Jay Bozovich. And now, here's Jay.
Good evening and welcome from downtown Elmira, Oregon. And it's another beautiful sunny day here on the West Coast. Understand they got some strange weather over in the east side, but it is pretty beautiful here on this side of the country. And this is the Bo's Nose Show. And as usual, if you want to get in on the conversation, you just need to dial 646-721-9887. Just press 1 if you want to get in on the conversation. So tonight's another free-for-all night. We are basically going to talk about whatever you feel like talking about or whatever I feel like talking about. If no one calls in, it'll be all just me talking about what I want to talk about, which I'm pretty good at for a pretty long time. So you might want to call in and interrupt me. But we got a few things we can throw out there. Some interesting things. I had two town halls this week with the Lane County Sheriff where we went to Benita and Florence this week. And like usual, it's always kind of difficult to get people to show up to those events. The Benita event was pretty well attended, about 25 or 30 people there. Florence event, I had 7 people and one member of the press there and the chief of police from Florence. So I guess a total of 9. So it wasn't very well attended, even though it had been in the newspaper and on the radio and advertised really strongly on Facebook. So it's always kind of disappointing, which is one of the reasons why I do this show, because it's another way people can call in and connect with me. And they don't have to show up somewhere at a specific time. You can always come in and listen to the show archived on the website anytime you want to and listen to past episodes. So it kind of puts me out there where people can listen anytime they want, get some information about Lane County or just politics in general. And they can always email me at talk@krbnradio.net if you have a question, even anytime during the week, and I'll try and cover it during the show. So tonight I want to talk about a couple things. One of the things that's come up in the both of our town halls was the sheriff announced in March that he was finally getting back to 24-hour patrol. And what people are asking is, didn't the board allocate money for that almost 2 years ago? And why did it take 21 months to get back to 24-hour patrol when the board, you know, had the money in the budget for it? And if it did take that long, what happened to the money that they allocated? So I'll attempt to answer that real quick because I listened to the sheriff explain it several times now. And basically, what happens when you make budget cuts is it's pretty easy. You kind of give the union a 60-day notice that you're probably going to be laying people off. And then at 30 days, you have to actually give the specific people you're going to lay off notices. Then there are some things that go on with unions about bumping and things like that. But ultimately, it's really quick and easy to make cuts. And when we made some pretty severe cuts back in 2008 and again in 2010, and the sheriff laid people off and cut back on jail beds and everything else, it was really easy to make those layoffs. And a lot of other agencies were really happy that we did because it's tough to recruit police officers in this state or corrections officers. So, you know, Clackamas and Washington and Marion County and Deschutes County, well, they were all right there waiting to hire these folks back up. When you go much more than a few months past a layoff, folks aren't hanging around here. You know, they all have families and car payments and mortgages, and you know, you can only go so far on unemployment. So they're gone, and you just can't recall those folks. All that's, you know, everybody has a right to their recall to their position. But once you get past about a year, those folks have melded back into the job market and they're no longer available. And it had been actually almost 2 years before the patrol had been down below 24 hours. It had been operating at about 20 hours in the last couple of years, but it actually got down to 16 for a while when we made some of those initial cuts. So when we authorized it back to 24 hour, the sheriff was able to get up to 20 hours just by using overtime. So that's where some of the money went, was he took his existing staff and stretched their schedules out and paid some overtime. And that's how we got 20 hour patrol from 16 hour patrol. And then he started the hiring process. Now, I don't know how many people out here own a business and have ever gone through a hiring process. But you advertise for people and you get many more applications in than you would expect. And a good portion of them never read the minimum qualifications. So right away, you can throw out half of them just because they don't meet the minimum qualifications. But what the sheriff would do is wait till he had about 100 qualified applicants. And at that time, he would offer them to come in and do what they call the physical agility test. And only about half those folks would show up, even for the physical agility test. And then only about half of the people that showed up could actually pass the physical agility test. And this is one of those things where they have to do like pull up, do so many sit-ups, that sort of thing, be able to run, walk a mile in a certain number of minutes. It's not what I would call the NFL combines. You know, you're not having to run a 4.2 40 or something like that. It's really not a hard test, but it's just to make sure you have some of the physical attributes that are going to be necessary to be a deputy. So by the time you finish that process, you're already down to about 25% of your applicant pool. Then you start the process of actually doing background checks, interviewing, and all that stuff. And of course, there's the old pee in the cup test, which, believe it or not, catches folks that are applying to be a law enforcement officer. And out of that 100 people, he might actually offer the job to 5 people. So, and that process just of advertising and going through the weaning out and then actually hiring those 5 people might take a couple months. So once you hire that person, it takes about 11 months before that person could actually be in a car by themselves patrolling Lane County. Part of that is they have to go through the Department of Public Safety and Standards. Basically, it's Police Academy. And that's about a 4 to 5 month process. And we lose folks there. There was one group of hirees where they sent 9 guys to the academy and only one of them made it out. So, you know, it's even then there's a weaning process. And then after they get out of the academy, they have to go through almost 5 months of in-car training with a full-blown deputy where they're sitting side by side. Now, mind you, in this whole 11-month process, from the day we hire them, we have to start paying them. They don't do all this training for free. They have families to feed and all that stuff too, or at least they got rent to pay and a food bill. At one point, we're paying overtime to go up to 20 hours. And while we're training all these folks, we're paying them. And when we eventually brought them on, after 21 months, we actually built up enough folks to go to full 24-hour patrol without using overtime. It was 21 months. It took that long to do that. And what happens with the money, basically, is a lot of it was spent on overtime. A lot of it was spent on training. And if there was money left over, the sheriff doesn't keep that money. That money rolls back into our budget as part of our ending fund balance, and we reallocate it in the next year's budget. So we just, instead of having our normal 10% reserve in our general fund, we might have had 10.1% or 10.2%, whatever he didn't spend out of that 24-hour patrol cost. But I guarantee he probably ate up most of it between overtime and training costs. So that's kind of why it takes so long. So it's always really difficult as a as any sort of agency, and businesses know this too, it's not particularly businesses that are involving people. It's really easy to lay off. It's really hard to ramp back up if you're a service-oriented business. And that's basically what law enforcement is. It takes people to do law enforcement, and the only way you can cut your budget is to cut people, which means you're cutting service, which is why, you know, we've dropped below 24-hour patrol. We dropped down to 115 jail beds. We finally got back to 24-hour patrol, and thanks to the sheriff's levy, we're actually back to 317 local jail beds. So it's really one of those things where it took a while even to ramp back up to those number of jail beds, and a lot of that was done with overtime in the first year. So that's kind of the story of what happens when you make budget cuts in a service industry. I watched it happen when I used to work as a consulting engineer, where we were people, you know, and our only way we could cut back when it came a hard time. And I went through several, because I worked in land development, doing consulting and land development. And there's always the boom bust cycle of residential and commercial construction. And it was really easy for companies to do those, you know, Black Friday layoffs that I was with and cut people back. I was fortunate that I was never cut in a layoff throughout my career. I don't know whether it was luck or just the fact that I was valuable enough to my companies, they didn't choose to lay me off. But I watched us lay people off. And then when the economy comes back, suddenly you're competing for a very limited skill set, particularly in engineering. It was tough. And I remember some of the boom times, us reaching as far as away as Texas, who was having an oil dirge at the time, and picking up engineers that had been working in the petroleum business and trying to convert them to civil engineers, and also hiring engineers that had graduated from colleges in other countries, and dealing with language barriers sometimes. So it's always easy to cut back, not so easy to ramp up. So that's kind of the story of 24-hour patrol. And again, if you want to get in on the conversation, you can just dial 646-721-9887 and just press 1 if you want to get in on the conversation. Another thing I wanted to talk about tonight is the concept of minimum wage. And this is something that I want to have somebody call in and explain to me this. Most people, and particularly the folks that have pushed this whole $15 minimum wage, that tend to be from a more liberal side of the spectrum, like the fact that people should be allowed to make choices for themselves. And particularly as adults, they're the same folks that will talk about the ability to marry whoever you feel like, to choose the recreational drug of your choice, whether it's alcohol or marijuana, freedom as an adult to make choices. And what I kind of wonder about is, what about the freedom to be able to negotiate how much you want to be paid? You know, where's that freedom? I want somebody that supports all those choices for adults to call me and explain to me why you shouldn't have the freedom to work for whatever wage you feel like working for, and why the government should set some minimum wage that you have to work at, or even that you have to work for a minimum wage. You know, here in Oregon, you can't do piecework anymore very easily because they basically made it almost impossible to pay people piecework. There was a little company out here in Blatchley, Oregon, which is a tiny little rural area, called Laughing Rabbit. And they started that whole photon light craze. You remember those keychain lights, you know, that press the button and they have a little LED light? Popular item was going gangbusters. And it was just a couple guys started that up in that area. And they were hiring local folks to assemble them. You know, they'd get, you know, bin of each part, and they would assemble them on a TV tray in front of the TV or on their dining room table and work really fast if they wanted to make a lot of money. Seniors were doing it while they were watching, you know, the Lawrence Welk show, whatever it was they were doing. Some people would put two or three together an hour. Some people were putting 200 together in an hour. And they got paid by piecework. Well, our state of Oregon decided that was not legal and that they needed to pay everybody a minimum wage while they're piecing those together, no matter how many they put together. And the company couldn't afford to either track people's time and do the minimum wage and all that stuff. So they moved the assembly of those lights offshore to China because we couldn't allow people the freedom to decide whether or not they were being fairly compensated for each one of those little lights they were putting together. Because we decided as a government here in Oregon that we knew better than those adults that had a deal with another adult to compensate them for their time to produce something. And I just, for the life of me, can't understand the folks that are pushing the $15 an hour minimum wage or push minimum wage in general, why we need that for people that are consenting adults. And if you're going to draw that line at 21, that's fine, or 18. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, having sub-minimum wage might be a little bit different, you know, for teenagers and stuff. And child labor laws make some sense because kids aren't, you know, up to the age where they can enter freely and with full consent and knowledge into a contract. We recognize that, and it's one of the reasons we have different child labor laws. But I just really challenge folks. Give me a call. Explain to me why adults need to have a minimum wage. I mean, I just, you know, numbers 646-721-9887. Just press 1. Email me at talk@krbnradio.net. And we'll have a discussion about that. But, you know, once upon a time ago, kids were allowed to do piecework. And it was usually with the knowledge of their parents, you know, and it was, you know, ask any 40-something and above in this area about it. They used to go to the local bean farm and pick beans, pick strawberries in the summertime. And, you know, some of the really little kids didn't make a whole lot of money, and some of the older kids could just make a killing. And, but, you know, with that, there has to be a little bit of oversight for the kids, you know, that maybe a parental sign off on that. You know, that made sense. And a lot of those farms have stopped doing high manual labor crops in this area and converted to crops they could harvest with a machine, because that labor force went away when they eliminated piecework for kids. And it just one of those things where the unintended consequences. And I don't think it harmed the kids. I don't think, you know, most of the folks that used to do that stuff remember some of the great things they used to get to buy with it. You know, I used to do a lot of work in the summertime, and I guess it would be piecework too. I used to go around and mow lawns at a certain amount per lawn. And we basically get paid by the lawn and the size of the lawn. And that was, you know, some lawns, if I was feeling lazy, might take me 3 or 4 hours. And if I was in a hurt, you know, could really move my butt, I might get the lawn done in an hour. But I paid for a lot of my snow skiing in the wintertime by doing stuff like that. So it was one of those things that you do as a kid. Minimum wage tends to do is it tends to create a community of people paying under the table. And at that point, you get into areas where you can actually take advantage of folks that are in this country illegally, and they're wanting to try and stay out of the government's eyes. And that gets almost like a form of slave labor. You know, so when you force that huge high minimum wage on people, you're actually encouraging the use of under the table labor, which can actually get into almost human trafficking. So, you know, give me give me a low minimum wage or no minimum wage, and I'm happy, because I think adults can make decisions to where they want to work for themselves. And that kind of goes right into the whole sick leave thing too. I think folks can decide and negotiate with their employers. You know, this whole thing that they were talking about, 1 hour sick leave for every 30 hours work. How hard would it have been for an employee to go to his boss and say, you know, I'll take a little bit less per hour if you'll give me sick time, paid sick time, and come to an agreement. And the boss will either say no, and the guy has a choice of going to work somewhere else and finding a job where the boss might say yes. Boss might say yes. But if they're both adults, they can work out whatever deal they want. So that's kind of where I am, you know, and it goes for a lot of things. And it gets into why government is involved in things. And this gets to, gay marriage and a few other issues where government has gotten involved. And I really believe that Alabama went the correct direction with marriage. They basically made it illegal to issue marriage licenses and took the government out of the marriage business. And it makes perfect sense. Folks can decide whether they want to get married or not. The only function government might have is maybe to register domestic partnership contracts between whoever wishes to have them, as long as they're both consenting adults. And then maybe the court system can be the arbiter of disputes in those contracts, like they are for any civil contract. But I just can't understand why we think the government should be in the business of licensing marriage and deciding who marries and who doesn't. The original way that government did get into licensing marriage, it didn't used to do it until the late 1800s, was specifically to try and prevent mixed marriages. And it was a racist thing. And it was, you know, there were lots of states that had blood tests when I was growing up in the South, just to make sure that there wasn't mixed marriages. I mean, that is one of the most outrageous things you can ever imagine. So I kind of wonder why states hang on to that power of issuing marriage licenses and not just registering contracts between people. But that kind of follows my general philosophy that, you know, once you're an adult, you should be able to make your own decisions and enter into contracts and agreements, whether it's how much you want to work for from an employer or how much, you know, who you want to marry, who you want to love, whether you want to use, you know, marijuana to relax on the weekend or whether you want to drink scotch on the weekend. That should be your choice, as long as you're not driving impaired or endangering others while you're impaired. That's shouldn't be anybody's business but your own. But there's a lot of folks that kind of think that for some reason, you know, they can legislate morality and then also kind of legislate, prosperity in the form of a minimum wage. And what they end up doing is actually legislating poverty, because people should understand what a minimum wage really is. It sets the minimum value of which a person's labor can become employable. So if the minimum wage becomes $15 an hour and your ability to work is only about worth $14 an hour, you're not employable. You know, if you're some young kid that's never had a job before in his life, doesn't have any experience, hasn't shown he can show up on time, work through a day, and stay for the entire shift, you may not be worth $15 an hour to a lot of employers. And, you know, some folks, tough thing, you know, to be worth that much. You know, we have a significant population of developmentally disabled folks in our society where they like to work. It's important. It's a value to them. They may not have to work to be independent because they're still living with their family or have some other support for their living arrangement. But to be able to go out and actually do something productive and get some kind of compensation is really a value to them. It makes them feel valuable. And a $15 minimum wage may completely close a lot of those folks out of the workforce. And it's really sad that we're heading that direction, that, you know, we're going to put young, unskilled labor, folks that have gotten poor educations just by, you know, where they live or the circumstance. They had parents that weren't responsible, folks that might have a disability of some kind. And we are basically going to say, you know what? We've decided arbitrarily, because we think we can make decisions for consenting adults, that your labor is not of high enough value to be employable, and you're going to be permanently unemployed. And that's really the result of what a minimum wage does. And I would challenge anyone to figure out a way to tell me differently that $15 an hour would, because if $15 an hour is good, 25 should be better. 75 would be great. So I was going to bring my producer here, Robin, in. It seems like she's got a few things to say about $15 an hour. So, Robin, what's on your mind?
Oh, thanks, Jay. Yeah, I've been saying for quite a while, one of the other people that our agency is going to really benefit from the $15 an hour, because you always got to ask why, follow the money. So I went ahead and ran the difference between a $10 an hour job and a $15 an hour job, and what that would be as far as take home and taxes. And this is using an online calculator. So in rough figures, a $10 an hour job, you're going to take home about, well, you're going to gross about $80 a week, roughly, and take home about $64.60 after taxes. $15 an hour, yeah, you'll gross $120, but you'll take home $95.59, paying $35 a week in taxes. So basically, you're almost paying more than double in taxes. And so under the guise of we're putting more money in people's pockets, the state and federal governments are also making out like a bandit too.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of this whole thing is, you know, will it push people into this whole higher tax bracket and everything else if they get the actual raise up to the $15 an hour?
Right.
What I predict, though, is we will actually see government costs go up because we still have to supply the services and all that, and we'll have to hire people at that higher wage. Because we're not like a business so much, although we'll probably find ways to automate too and use less people, or we'll just have less service. But you'll see the private sector is already looking at, you know, you're seeing touchscreen ordering menus and fast food joints. We're going to see other innovations where we're going to eliminate people and bring automation in, or there'll be price increases at those businesses, their demand will go down and they'll lay people off due to the increased prices as they move people up to $15 an hour. And ultimately the labor force will get smaller. So even though we might get people earning $15 an hour and paying a little bit more income tax in the short run, I think in the long run, you'll actually see less people in the workforce and more people actually on the entitlement programs. And it's actually going to be a higher cost to governments and a lower income ultimately.
Well, and you can forget about overtime.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can, you know, and one of the things you'll probably see is businesses, and this goes along with some of the healthcare mandates and the sick leave mandates, they're going to start hiring more people in some ways, but work them far less hours. So you're going to see a lot more 28-hour employees and a lot less 40-hour employees, because then they don't have to pay the full load of benefits. They won't qualify for a lot of the mandates, and they can, and then that way they're never close to overtime. should somebody not show up for their shift and they got to get somebody to stay an extra an hour or two. Well, it's no big deal because they're only scheduled for 28 hours. So if they work them an extra 6 hours, you're nowhere near overtime. Whereas if you got if you only have enough employees that they're all working 40-hour weeks and somebody calls in sick and you got to keep somebody over, you're instantly into time and a half. So that's I think what you're going to see is this people having to work 2-3 jobs because they can't get anything more than 20-25 hours in a work week from their employer, and trying to juggle the schedules, you know, between those jobs, and the schedules might change weekly and stuff like that. It's going to be really hard on folks. So
it's not just that, you got to also consider the infrastructure. They're already talking about having a per mile tax because cars are getting better mileage and they can't afford to upkeep roads. So what are they going to do when the cost of labor goes up by another 20% or so?
Yeah, it's going to be pretty serious. I mean, for us, we hire the only folks we really hire that are close to minimum wage at the county are mostly temporary employees, mostly doing park maintenance in the summertime and doing road maintenance, vegetation maintenance in the summertime. That's our biggest group of temporary employees, is in those two places. So those are folks that are out there weed whacking the blackberries around the guardrails and mowing the park and picking up trash and that sort of thing. You know, if those folks cost us more, we may just not be able to hire as many. So we won't get as much, you know, blackberries pulled around the guardrails. They'll start encroaching on the shoulders where the bikes usually ride. So they're going to be riding more out into the drive lanes. Parks won't be kept up as much. So people are going to, you know, maybe not want to be at them as much. We may not sell as many park passes. It's just, you know, it's a slippery, steady slope down into the quagmire of limiting freedoms. You know, and every time we make a decision as government, or the people make a decision overall as a government to limit freedom, it ends up costing us in some way, either in prosperity or economic activity, or in just having to do a lot of enforcement activity. I mean, we all know what happened when we decided to declare prohibition in the 20s, and what that led to in the whole increase in police forces and federal police forces. The IRS and the FBI grew rapidly under that regime, and there was a lot of violence in the black market for alcohol. It wasn't a good thing when we limited freedom. And we're realizing as we're starting to lift some of the prohibitions on marijuana that it's actually relieving some of the necessity to police all that. And it's actually already having an impact on the illegal grows that were happening in our federal forest. We're not seeing as many of those cartel grows where they would go in and illegally clear a spot in a remote area of the forest, put a couple guys camping there, a bunch of booby traps around it, and make a grow there in Northern California or Southern Oregon, and completely spoil that area of the forest. They use a lot of chemicals on their marijuana, and those places are virtually disappearing now with the legalization in Oregon and Washington and Colorado, because they really can't compete with the legal growers now. Even though a lot of some of the legal grows being diverted into the black market, at least it isn't cartels from Mexico where they're using slave labor out there in the middle of the forest and, you know, chaining dogs up and doing all sorts of terrible things to protect their valuable crop. So anytime you limit freedom, I think you're going to have a bad result. There has to be a really important reason to limit a freedom of any kind. And I think what we have a tendency to do as a society is wanting to protect people so badly from themselves that we choose to limit freedoms quite often where we don't need to. And that's not a good thing all the time. I can tell that you know, this $15 an hour minimum wage is going to have an impact in Oregon. I mean, we're not quite getting to 15, but it'll be interesting to see what happens in California. Now they've passed their statewide $15 an hour. They take a little longer to get there till 2022. But I predict that there's going to be some pretty tough economic times for California. There's going to be some tough economic times coming for Oregon, as well as Seattle and SeaTac, where they've passed these $15 an hour wages. In fact, the Seattle area has already seen a steady decrease in employment that matches actually the decrease in employment in 2008 at the start of the recession. Some people call it a depression that I don't know if we've ever really come out of, but if you look at some of the graphs of employment in the Seattle area, and it's actually turned down significantly in the last 3 months at a rate that equals the initial turn down in 2008. So anyone that wants to tell me that it doesn't really have an impact because some smaller raises in some states didn't really cause a lot of issues right at first, take a look at Seattle employment figures. So what else can we talk about tonight?
Well, kind of like on the same line, you know, we have, I guess, Ford just announced that they're going to be leaving the country because of costs. And Obama was just talking about that same issue the other day and even suggesting an exit tax on companies that want to leave. But the reason why they're leaving is because taxes, high cost of labor, and it's just snowballed all down the line.
Yeah. Well, it's that recent merger between Pfizer and I can't remember the name of the Irish company, Allergan or something like that. That was going to be one of those upside down corporate flipovers where they were going to merge and then re-headquarter in Ireland. And that's because Ireland has a 15% maximum corporate tax rate. Ours is 35%. It's like, why wouldn't a company want to locate where they're not being taxed so heavily? And what people really don't understand about corporate taxes, and this is, you know, if I had my magic wand and I was president, one of the things I would propose is a 0% corporate tax rate. Because, one, it would draw a lot of those companies back to America and headquarter them here. But, two, corporations don't pay taxes. People don't understand that, you know, there's no Joe corporation that writes a check and pays the U.S. government. What they do is they take part of their earnings that they get from whatever they're selling, whether it's services or goods, and that is built into the price of that service, and that's what they hand to the government. And because they are handing that to the government, they hand out less dividends to their shareholders, and they hand out less raises to their employees. So the only people that really pay corporate taxes are you, the customer, you, the employee of the corporation, or you, the stockholder in the corporation. And anyone that's got a 401k, that matters. So, you know, that's who pays corporate. You know, we should really look to get our taxes from people that are paying them more directly. Whether it's a sales tax, so you're getting it directly from people that are purchasing something, or an income tax. A flat income tax would be better, or, you know, a national sales tax would be best, but we can, that's a whole nother discussion for another day. But if we could go to zero corporate tax, it would keep prices down in America. It would allow for, you know, the raises people want with these minimum wages, and it would also benefit everybody's retirement accounts. So, you know, and it would bring thousands of jobs back into America and corporate headquarters back into America. And, you know, those corporate headquarters pay property taxes to your local governments. They might pay state income taxes, you know, but it's, you know, that's would be the biggest, if we went to a 0% corporate tax, I predict in the next year we see a 5% GDP growth, if not closer to 10, because it would stimulate America's economy so fast. It would make heads spin around the world. Probably make a few liberals' heads spin right off their neck, but because they always think.
To throw something else on there too, this is from Jesse Ventura, which I don't normally agree with, but he came out with a very good point. Abolish the federal income tax and change and swap it out with a federal sales tax. Now, I don't like sales tax, as we said here in Oregon 9 times, no way. But his reasoning kind of makes sense. He says at the current rate now, the government gets your money before you get your money. If you put it down to a federal sales tax, you get your money, and they are more in tune with the economy.
Yeah. Well, one of the things about a sales tax is it's visible. What I really dislike about the income tax, for a lot of people, it's not very visible. I mean, most people, you ask them, how much do you make? And they go, well, I take home X amount. You know,
yeah.
They don't tell you that I make, you know, $50,000 a year. Or they'll tell you, oh, well, I take home about, you know, $600 a month or $800 a month or whatever it is. And they're not thinking about all the taxes that come out of their check. And then when they go to file their taxes in March and April, they're happy when they're getting money back. You'll hear people talk about, oh, I'm getting a great refund this year. It's like, that was your money.
Yeah, in Oregon, government taxes that too.
Yeah, yeah. They're giving you back your money.
Yeah,
and it's frustrating. It's an invisible tax, and what happens with income taxes, particularly corporate income taxes, people pay them in the price of the product. They have no idea, and it's multiplying. So, right. There's a company that mines iron ore somewhere in Michigan, and they pay a corporate tax. And then there's the steel company that smelts that, and they pay income tax. And then that gets manufactured into a car by Ford, and they pay a corporate income tax. And then it goes to a dealership, and the dealership sells you that car, and they pay a corporate income tax. And the price of that car includes all those corporate income taxes the whole way along. You know, and it's a hidden tax. Whereas if it was a sales tax at the retail level, not at business-to-business sales, you know, at the retail level to the final customer, and it was on everything, so we couldn't play politics with what we're going to exempt from sales tax and what we're not, and argue about whether snack foods should be exempt or not, or, you know, sodas with sugar in them or not, pay a sales tax. Everything should get broad sales tax so it stays low as possible, and you see it on your receipt every time you buy something. So everybody understands they're paying that tax. That's the best part about a sales tax. It's visible to the person paying it.
Oh, I'll take you one further. Every time you get a paycheck, you got to cut a check for the taxes that you owe.
Yeah, that would be a better way to do it. You know, withholding tax, I think, is one of the most deceitful things this country does. If people had to write a check back every time they got a paycheck, or write a quarterly check, like a lot of higher income folks have to do, pay quarterly taxes that like are self-employed. We've been there. My wife was a Schedule C sole proprietor for a long time. We paid quarterly taxes. You understand how much you're paying.
Oh yeah.
When you're writing that check every quarter out to the government, you know you're paying taxes versus it just disappears from your weekly or biweekly paycheck. And it's just, you only look at the amount that's in the amount box, and you're not really looking at the stub, at the gross amount. Yeah, that's one of the most inventive things government ever did and allowed them to grow like crazy was to start withholding taxes. So
much participation without representation.
Yeah,
just like I can say, I paid a lot of money to LTD, but I've never once ridden the bus.
Yep, and everybody's paying that LTD tax. Every business you use in the LTD service area or within 2 miles of a bus stop, which includes my wife and I's business, pays LTD tax. If they have payroll, you pay it as a percentage of your payroll. And so if you go in to buy a sub at Subway on West 11th, you're paying LTD taxes on that price of that sub, and you don't even know it. Even if you drove to the Subway and you never ride the bus, you're subsidizing all those bus riders' fares. Fares only make up about 20% of LTD's revenue. So 80% is being subsidized by everybody else. So don't get me started on LTD or MX. I am proud. I am proud that I am the only elected official to vote against the West Eugene MX extension. When I was on the... You knew there was a reason why you liked me? Somebody else said that to me when I told them that the other day. So if you want to get in on this conversation, we can talk MX, we can talk minimum wage, we can talk corporate taxes or sales tax. It's 646-721-9887. Just press 1, or you can email me at talk@krbnradio.net. So, Robin, you said you didn't like sales taxes. Is that just because you've been an Oregonian for so long, or have you really thought hard about how you'd like to be taxed? You know, if the state got rid of the income tax and went to a sales tax, would you be okay with it then?
If the state totally got rid of the income tax and the sales tax was set up so they can't be tinkered with, but when it looked like at one point that the sales tax was going to be a reality, all of a sudden we started talking about county sales tax, city sales tax, all these other sales taxes being placed on top of that.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that happens sometimes. You see everybody jump on the bandwagon. I've seen that with in other states. California is probably most notable for it. So it's kind of one of those things where you got to make a decision as a state whether you're okay with local sales taxes versus just having one statewide sales tax and it's only for state revenue, and if you want to keep it open for local revenue or not. Because once you have a mechanism for collecting sales taxes, it's kind of like the gas tax. It's pretty easy for local governments to pass a gas tax and have the state collect it for them and return it back. It's fairly cheap way of getting it collected. So, yeah, that's one danger of a sales tax in some ways. But a national sales tax would be very difficult for a locality to ask the federal government to collect that for them. One of the things I'd like to see, though, with a sales tax would be a prebate program where every citizen in the state got a certain amount of money back every quarter in the form of a check that would be equal to approximately amount of sales tax you'd spend if you're at the poverty level of income. So it would kind of give you back a certain amount of sales tax, or, you know, actually give it to you at the beginning of the quarter so that you could afford the sales tax for that quarter if you were at the poverty level. If you're twice the poverty level, be subsidizing a portion of your sales tax. And if you're, you know, richy rich and you're spending lots of money on big fancy things, it's going to hardly put a dent in your sales tax bill. But it's one of the ways of kind of making it at least not something that where we're asking folks that are extremely poor to pay a tax like that. It makes it a little bit more fair. Would be fairly easy thing to do to get that system of checks being sent out every quarter to, you know, every family in the state. You know, if there's a family of four, they get a certain check, and if it's, you know, just a single person, they get a check. But it'd be a pretty easy thing to take care of. It would also capture the out-of-state folks coming in and spending money in the state. They wouldn't be getting that prebate on the taxes.
Right. The only thing I could see wrong with that is just like what happens every year with Oregon's kicker and how they kick and scream about that, and then it becomes a tax credit.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, if you made sure it was purely about refunding the amount that somebody would spend at the federal poverty level. I can't imagine somebody kicking and screaming about making sure folks that are at poverty level get their sales tax rebate. That's also what would enable you to put sales tax on every item rather than broadly than trying to exempt certain items, because it's not fair to put it on food because folks that are poor would have to pay it.
Yeah, right.
Because I've been in states that have sales taxes, and it gets to be a game about what they tax and what they don't tax, and it becomes social engineering in a lot of ways, which, you know, here we go, limiting freedom again, where they'll put it on things they think that are bad and try and take it off things they think are good for people or that they have to have, you know, as a working poor person, and make all sorts of arguments about why somebody should be in or out, which means then there's a good reason to have a lobbyist to try and lobby for your product to be exempted from a sales tax. And it gives the government a lot of power. So if it's, you know, everybody pays it on everything, it takes away that power and you don't get the lobbyist in there. And the prebate's what makes that fair. So you can say, we're putting it on everything because we're going to give folks in poverty their sales tax back.
Right. It'd also be kind of nice if the sales tax was incorporated in the price of goods like gas is, so you don't get up to the counter and, you owe us an extra 35 cents or something.
No, I actually think it's better that way. In fact, if I had it my way, when you pumped your gas, your receipt would come out with the gas price and then the taxes separated and then total for whatever it is. I mean, you still if you said you wanted the price per gallon would include the tax, but the actual receipt you got would separate it. So that you could see that, you know, when you go to the pump and you say, I want $10 worth of regular, and you end up getting, you know, 5 gallons approximately, say it's $2 a gallon, and your receipt comes back and it says gas $6, tax, you know, $3.10, you know, state tax 90 cents, you know, that would kind of get people to start saying, oh my God, look how much I'm paying for my roads.
Exactly. I could go along with that.
And look how much gas would be if they weren't taxing the hell out of it.
Exactly. Hey, yeah. Since we're down to about the last 5 minutes, you're doing some town halls, and do you want to talk about where you're going and briefly touch on some of the questions or subjects that was brought up?
Sure. And you know, my two town halls I had last night and then Monday night, a lot of the questions were around coverage of the sheriff's department, how we make decisions around letting people out of the jail was a common question. And, you know, really issues like that around public safety quite a bit. You know, why don't we get more deputies? We think we're paying enough taxes to have the coverage we should have. I'm trying to explain how much money we've lost from the federal forest. I have a couple graphs I'm taking around with me in the town halls that show the decrease in federal forest funding to the county, which has been, you know, extreme. But I'm trying to look real quick here for my town hall list. You caught me cold there. here it is. So my next town hall is coming up on April 18th. It's a Monday night at Messiah Lutheran Church. And that's in Santa Clara neighborhood of Eugene. And it's 3280 River Road. And it starts at 6:30 p.m. All the town halls I'm doing are starting at 6:30 p.m., trying to get out there where people that work can get to me. A lot of times when I do my community conversations where I go to coffee houses and stuff, they're during the day. So I'm specifically trying to do these town halls in the evening. So Messiah Lutheran Church, April 18th at 6:30 in Santa Clara. The Mapleton's Lion Club the next night on April 19th, and that's Mapleton, Oregon, obviously. And that's at 6:30 also. And then we're going to be out in Blatchley, Oregon at the Triangle Lake School Library on April 25th, the following week. So April 18th, in Santa Clara at Messiah Lutheran, April 19th in Mapleton at the Lions Club, April 25th in Blatchley at the Triangle Lake School. At 6:30 is all of those. So those are the dates you can get out and actually meet me in person, meet the sheriff in person, and ask us the questions you want to ask. You know, we spent a little bit of time at the beginning of the program about 24-hour patrol, but you can hear it directly from the sheriff. If you want to know why we aren't coming to your burglary, or if you want to know about concealed weapon permits or all sorts of interesting things, he'll be there to answer a lot of those questions. You want to know why the county is doing this or that, or you know, what happened to dust control on the gravel road I live on, I can try and answer some of those questions. But they've been good so far. We've gotten some really great questions from the audience. It's always complex, the separation of what's county government, municipal government, state, federal government. It's always something people struggle with, and one of the things we can do is help explain that, what we do have control over and what we don't have control over. So come on out and we can have a conversation there, just like we can have a conversation on this radio program anytime you want to, just by dialing in 646-721-9887. But we are getting close to the end of the program.
Do you also get some good suggestions out there at those meetings?
There were some people that had some ideas. The one thing I have heard is there was actually a couple people that were promoting the idea of the county having its own gas tax for roads instead of, you know, that they were the vehicle registration fee that failed. They felt wasn't fair because you were going to get taxed the same on a trailer that you might use two or three times a year as you would on your car you might use every day. And, you know, folks that had multiple vehicles would pay more than the folks that might have only two, but still drive them. They only had two drivers, you know, in both households. So they're actually on the roads the same amount of time. So he, you know, this one gentleman thought we should have a countywide gas tax. And the one thing he didn't understand was we can't tax gas stations inside of city limits. As the county, we don't have the power to do that. We would have to ask the cities to do that for us. And there's some limitations on local gas tax. A lot of the cities already have their own gas tax, so they won't be too happy about that. So we don't raise a lot of money with a countywide gas tax because there's not that many gas stations that are outside of city limits, unfortunately. So, you know, it was a good idea, just maybe not raise the kind of money for roads that he thought it might raise. But, you know, there's a lot of people that wanted us to try and bolster our volunteers in the sheriff's department to try and help out with that. And, you know, one of the things people aren't realize we have 250 or so volunteers in the sheriff's department right now. But it does take staff to manage volunteers, and that's one thing we're short on is that staff. So we do what we can, but it is they do come up with some ideas, not just complaints at times. And that's one of the good things I like to hear about is, what do you think we should be doing? That's the best comments I get in town halls is, we'd like you to try this and that. So we're just about ready to wrap it up for the Bo's Nose Show here in lovely downtown Elmira, Oregon. And I'm hoping that you all have a really nice evening tonight. And I hope that wherever you are, you're enjoying the same great weather we are. And hopefully you'll think about our conversation tonight and think about the next time it's easy for you to want to limit somebody's liberty and freedom and kind of step back for a moment and realize there are unintended consequences of that. And the most prosperous society is usually the freest society. And with that, I will say thank you and good night from the Bo's Nose Show.